Welcome, hardworking writers, strenuous procrastinators, multi-brained multitaskers, jumping jugglers, and every kind of do-it-aller. I'm Grant Faulkner, and I'm here with Brooke Warner, my co-host on Right Minded, who is certainly a do-it-aller. Brooke, I use these words to describe writers because our guest today, Bridget Quinn, told me that she practices productive procrastination, which means that she'll work on whatever project that calls her and essentially jump from project to project. So she's not working continuously on one project. She's kind of procrastinating because she might be avoiding a project, but she's still working, so she's productive. And I really related to that. I'm often actually embarrassed when people ask me what I'm working on, which can literally change from week to week and certainly month to month. So I might be working on three or four projects simultaneously. That's what I'm doing now, which means I don't often have a clear answer to this question. And the odd thing to me is that I didn't decide on this writing rhythm. It essentially found me because I have different deadlines or book proposals due, but I really like it because I'm usually working on something I'm excited about, and I tend not to get too burned out by any single project. My guess is that you might define yourself somewhat this way because you seem to always be working on a book project, and I know you write a regular column for Publishers Weekly, and then there are always other things beyond life itself. What is your juggling philosophy or approach, and does procrastination figure into things, or are you more clearly about straight up productivity?
Yeah, you know, procrastination does factor in for me. I wish I could say it didn't. I'm really deadline driven. And I think when people say that they're acknowledging that the deadline is the reason that they're doing the writing, it's because they probably have a little bit of a tendency to procrastinate. I think most of us do. You know, without a due date from Publishers Weekly, for instance, or without me deciding that I'm going to publish a book project and then giving myself a due date or even a publication date, I probably wouldn't have any writing credits to my name. So I guess you could say that I kind of trick myself out of procrastinating sometimes, or that, like Bridget, I'm a productive procrastinator because I don't procrastinate to the point of abjectly stressing myself out, but that looming deadline definitely lights a fire under me. And I know I've mentioned this too in previous podcasts that I respond really, really well to accountability. And I do think that accountability is the antidote to procrastination because it's all about creating structures to keep you from procrastinating. And I do that for other people in my coaching. So I know how valuable it is, and I have to kind of, you know, create those little fires under myself so that I get stuff done.
Yeah, I'm obviously a big believer in deadlines and accountability because NaNoWriMo is a deadline and accountability machine. It's also an anti-procrastination machine in its way as well. I'm interested in procrastination, though, because there are so many flavors of it. People often associate it with laziness, but it's more about your emotional state, I think. In fact, the best definition of procrastination for me is that it's about fear. You're afraid of failing at a project or embarrassing yourself because you're inadequate in some way. So it's akin to performance anxiety, I think. The thing I like about this notion of productive procrastination is that it makes your avoidance into something positive. And I Googled productive procrastination after swapping emails with Bridget, and the person who came up with the term is a man named Piers Steele. What a great name. And he said that we are willing to pursue any vile task as long as it allows us to avoid something worse, which does essentially describe my day, a search for doing the least vile thing, which is a pretty good strategy for productivity. But more positively, he gave credit to his theory to Sir Francis Bacon, the 17th century philosopher whose self-control strategy was to set affection against affection and to master one by another, which is like Bridget's process of choosing between two writing projects she has affection for and being fueled by whichever affection she pursues. I've heard of people who make a list of the things they need to do, starting with the big projects and then listing a lot of smaller, less consequential items. And they do all the smaller items first. So they're strangely being productive as they gather the courage and fortitude to tackle the big projects. So avoidance can be productive in its way, and it can be a spring to feed your creativity as long as you don't entirely avoid the things you want to work on.
Yeah, and that's so interesting to me, Grant, because I think you're explaining the maxim. If you want to get a job done, give it to a busy person. You're saying that the more we pile upon ourselves in some way, the more traction we're gaining to do the big thing. So thank you for that, because I think you just solved the riddle of how and why busyness begets getting stuff done. But I do want to go back for just a second to that quote from Sir Francis Bacon, because I feel like I'm struggling a little bit to take it in. And I always like to repeat stuff for listeners when I feel that way. So his self-control strategy was to set affection against affection and to master one by another. So the idea here is that to have multiple irons in the fire, things you're equally passionate about. So that's the one. And then mastering one by another. Can you just unpack that a little bit more for me and for our listeners too?
Sure. I think the gist of it is to have competing projects or affections. So sometimes you go with one project because it's calling you more and you stay with it until you tire of it, or and your other affection calls you perhaps more loudly. So it's like spending time, I think, with one friend who likes quiet evenings of going to the movies, and then spending time with another friend who likes going to loud rock concerts. They're not mutually exclusive activities, and they can speak to different sides of yourself. It just depends on which friend you want to see on a Friday or Saturday night. I think there is a danger in this approach because you can't end up going back and forth and not finishing anything. But if you're disciplined, then you're always working on something you're enjoying, and one creative project nourishes another by definition in my mind, just because they kind of coexist and speak to each other. But some of deadlines and accountability structures help with this, of course.
Yeah, thanks for that. It definitely gives me something to chew on for a while over here. So now that we're talking about procrastination, do you have a story or a memory of something that was like your worst procrastination moment ever?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a single moment, but when I think of writing and procrastination, it's always about fear and or lack of interest or excitement in the subject matter. And I used to be a freelance writer, and I'd get these very well-paying assignments for me. They're well-paying, but they were to write very complex technology stories for technology magazines. And the tough thing was that I knew almost nothing about technology, and I had little interest as well. So I was just nervous as hell about every stage of the articles, from the interview to writing it. And I remember procrastinating in the worst of ways. Everything about that was painful. So my procrastination wasn't fueled by any sort of competing affections. I've never experienced this with my personal writing, though. You know, bad days, yes. Exhaustion or burnout, yes, but never outright fear, pain, and an avoidance. How about you, Brooke?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think it just makes me think about how sometimes, even if you're getting paid really well, it's just not worth it if it's too painful. But the story that's coming to mind for me is just about when I have to prep for talks, because I don't really procrastinate when I write. I do a pretty good job. I know how to give myself accountability structures, as I said. But when it comes to preparing for talks, I can just get to this place where I just want to like think it over and over in my head and then not write it down. Sometimes I think this works to my advantage because there's something about the urgency of the moment in the last few days where I get it all on the page. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, but I did not do this for my TEDx talk. You know, it was pretty clear that there was no way I could wait until 5 days before the talk and then pull that off, particularly because I memorized it. And so I prepped for months and months in advance, and I calculated that I probably spent about 100 hours at least on that talk. And so it sort of begs the question why I wouldn't prep for some of my other talks in a similar way. I mean, maybe not 100 hours, but even 10 hours and at least far in advance. But an Atlantic article called Why Writers Are the Worst Procrastinators helped me to understand my tendency. It turns out it's not super uncommon. The article broke down an interesting phenomenon about people who are naturally good at things. And if being naturally good at something gets reinforced enough times, you can start to think that you don't really need to prep or that you can do so at the last minute. And so I think that's what was going on for me, or does go on for me, because I'm a decent extemporaneous speaker. The problem is that's my baseline. And so that's how good I am when I'm not really embracing hard work. So this has been a helpful insight for me because, as I said, my TEDx talk was something of a whole nother level, and I am really proud of how that went. And it pushed me out of my comfort zone. And I think the reason it went so well is because I did not procrastinate. And so even though it was a super stressful experience, I went into it knowing I was prepared. So the worst thing that could have happened was that I could have frozen up or choked, but gratefully that didn't happen.
Thanks for bringing up speaking. I wasn't thinking about public speaking in terms of writing, but I definitely procrastinate when it comes to writing a speech, which again, I think is about fear, the performance anxiety part of things. And then the memorization is never pleasant as well. But I wonder if memorizing a speech for me, which is fraught with, I don't know, the pain similar to those tech articles, I wonder if it would be different or is different for like stand-up comedians who are memorizing their acts, but like it's more like I write. They're focusing on the creative and fun aspects of what they're doing. So I'll read that Atlantic article. It sounds really interesting. I always think the best recipe for giving the best speech is actually to find the balance between preparation and improv. You don't want to be talking to the speech, in other words, but to the audience. So you need to maintain a spirit of spontaneity in order to be more in conversation with them. And I think this applies to writing as well. So if I go back in time to write those horrible tech articles, I'll have to approach them with that mindset.
And ask for a lot more money.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to talk with Bridget about this and more. Her upcoming book, She Votes, How Women Won Suffrage, reminds me of a book written by a Bay Area teacher who taught NaNoWriMo to her high school students. Her name is Kate Schatz. She wrote the best-selling Rad American Women A to Z, which combines interesting profiles along with gripping illustrations done by Miriam Klein-Stahl, who teaches at Berkeley High. I love the interplay of text and visuals because they read like a graphic novel in a way. So you get a lot of information in small telling doses, and it's all reinforced with illustrations. And I'm really into books like these, this particular format right now, because there's something that James and I can share together.
Yeah. So let's find out more about Bridget Quinn, who will join us after this short break. Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to introduce my friend and fellow podcaster, Bridget Quinn, who is the author of the forthcoming book, She Votes, How U.S. Women Won Suffrage and What Happened Next. And she's the award-winning author of Broad Strokes, 15 Women Who Made Art and Made History in That Order, which is an Amazon pick for Best Art and Photography Books of 2017 and a 2018 Amelia Bloomer List selection of recommended feminist literature from the American Library Association. And I want to note that Bridget has an interesting past as well. She was raised on the high plains of Montana with six brothers, two sisters, a sporty mother, and a World War II Marine turned lawyer father in a home surrounded by cows and nuclear missiles. That almost sounds like the pitch for a memoir, which I think might be in motion. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you. Yes, a memoir I find compelling and amusing, but so far no one else does. So I'm glad you think that.
They will. They will.
Okay, thanks.
And Bridget, we had an email exchange before this interview that I thought was interesting in terms of the writing process. You told an interviewer after Broad Strokes was published that you were hard at work on this memoir about growing up in a family of 11 in Montana in the 1970s. But then after that interview, you went on to publish She Votes. And then you just sold the book Painting Ladies about the artistic rivalry between two 18th century French portraitists. So the memoir is at least a little bit on hold.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you work with what you call productive procrastination. That was the first time I heard that term, but it totally mirrors my writing process as well. And so can you tell us more about what productive procrastination is and why it works for you?
Sure. I guess productive procrastination, which I think I coined, or I at least coined it for myself, is just a way to not go crazy with anxiety and nerves when I'm attacking something that needs to happen. So I often get a lot of really good creative writing done when I have a deadline for something else. And in fact, my book, She Votes, ends with a moment of very productive procrastination, wherein a almost sublime moment of synchronicity happens because I'm not doing what I'm supposed to.
I thought you coined it too. And then I did some internet research, and some researcher actually has, maybe it came to him from you, but anyway, it's an official psychological term. So
you're
part of the productive procrastination movement, maybe.
Excellent.
Bridget, you're truly on a tear because Broad Strokes came out in 2017. I know you just sold Painting Ladies, then She Votes, and What Happens Next has just been published to commemorate 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. I really like She Votes because you profile women leaders in the suffrage movement, but also notable women in art, sports, politics, and music. So can you tell us about why you wrote that book in particular, and what were the most interesting things you discovered in your research?
Sure. Well, I guess a passion of mine and an abiding interest has always been unknown stories in history, untold stories. I was trained as an art historian, not as a writer, and really have made my living. You will be surprised to hear it is difficult to make a living as a writer. I have made my living as an art historian in my adult life, either as a teacher or working in museums or for galleries. So I was especially interested in my case, women artists whose work and whose lives had been overshadowed or completely lost. So I had spent decades really kind of seeking out and collecting maybe lesser known stories of women in history. And I also was a high school teacher and taught history. And so it began to range outside of just art history. So when the suffrage centenary was coming up, I was actually approached by Chronicle, who's my publisher for Broad Strokes, to say, would you know of a, I can't remember how they put it, something like a kind of sweary but solid historian who could write about the history of the women's movement in the United States. And we would illustrate it with 100 women artists. And I gave them a few names and they came back and said, well, what about you? And I thought, yeah, what about me? I'm going to do that. So that's how it came about, was that I kind of already had this in my quiver, I guess. But also just had a moment of, you know, great fortune.
That's so cool. In an interview about your book, Broad Strokes, which profiles 15 women artists and their impact on the art world and history, you said, simply making art as a woman is always a feminist act. It's an insistence on being seen and on making others see the world from a woman's point of view. However apparently banal the subject matter, this is in itself revolutionary. And so I'm curious about how this applies to your own writing, whether it's She Votes or the personal essays you write or your other upcoming book.
Oh, that's it. Really interesting. I didn't realize you were going to go there with that question. So I was already thinking about what the She Votes example of that was, but
you can answer it that way too.
Okay. So the She Votes example of the banal, seemingly banal subject is Mary Cassatt's depictions of mothers and children, which seems so banal to us, especially now, a little bit saccharine and overly sweet. But except for the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, no one really cared about mothers and children in art. And so to position that subject matter beneath the dignity of great art as something worthy of oil painting, of oil painting at a very high level, is a feminist act. And in fact, Mary Cassatt used those paintings to raise money for women's suffrage and had a complete break with her family over supporting suffrage. Hmm. So this part of her oeuvre that we look at as so maybe too sweet now was really badass and feminist in its day and seen as that. For myself, I guess I think about it, this is going to be so petty. I'm going to say it anyway. for example, when I read reviews of Broad Strokes, nobody do this on Amazon. All of the negative reviews are by men. And almost all of them say, I don't want to hear about her. Basically, why is she talking? Because Broad Strokes, and a little bit She Votes too, has my story in with the story of these artists. And it is both a writerly impulse, right, to write about oneself and to situate your own eye in the story. But it's also, for me, an act of saying my story, like any woman's story, matters. And it matters to me, but it also matters that I am able to speak for myself and to situate myself in this narrative.
I also think it's important because, I mean, you were saying it's almost petty, and yet so many women, it's almost this way in which we apologize for ourselves, you know, so standing up and saying, like, this is where I'm situated and I'm doing this work and it matters. Like, I personally love it. Well, Bridget, all of your books are art oriented and illustrated. So could you tell us more about what it's like to merge narrative with the visual arts, and how does the interplay of images specifically work with your prose? I'm just curious about, you know, how those things in your background merge together for you.
Yeah. Well, I think it was more clear with broad strokes because I was really talking about the work itself. In the case of She Votes, the artwork is almost illustrations. Not really, but the artwork is responding to the text rather than the other way around. I think having taught art history for so long, and especially because I taught undergraduates and high school students, I tried to develop a narrative strategy for talking about art that was not deadly boring and a bludgeon to them. And so I felt pretty well equipped when I started writing Broad Strokes to talk about art in a way that was accessible and also energetic, because I love art and I'm still excited and psyched by it, but still informed and in a way scholarly, like slipping it in the scholarly framework maybe of the story. But for me, the most important thing is the story, which in the world of art history is very suspect. That's not something that is, I would say, highly valued or even respected in art history. But what I know as an educator and what I know as a reader is that story is everything. And if you can, you know, engage the emotion, that makes you care about art work and a specific artist. And the same is true about the stories in history, I think.
Well, Bridget, when we were emailing each other, you mentioned that you had come to publishing later in life, as did I. And so I wanted to turn back to procrastination just for a moment, which is a common, you know, occupational hazard of writing. And I'm guessing procrastination wasn't the reason you came to publishing later in life, right?
No, not at all.
Okay. Tell me your story. You said you had an interesting story around this.
Well, okay. I guess a couple of things. One is I don't feel like I came to writing late. I feel like I came to publishing late.
Right.
I actually published my first really significant piece, which was creative nonfiction, was in an anthology by Seal Press called Solo on Her Own Adventure about women in the outdoors. And I think I was 26. And I was determined, like a lot of people in my 20s, to be a writer. I left my PhD program to become a writer in art history. And then I, at 30, had my first child. And unlike a lot of people, I really found it almost impossible to write and raise small children. And so I think I didn't write for about 6 years, like seriously write in the sense of shaping or forming something. But besides that 6 year period, I've written, and when I still journaled, I still wrote, but I didn't try to publish. I didn't do much beyond that. Besides that period, I've really written steadily my entire adult life and saw myself as a writer. I published steadily in a way too. I mean, in anthologies, in magazines, in literary magazines. And the reason, I think it was Brooke had mentioned that this sequence of books I suddenly have in 5 years, I've sold 3 books. And that seems so crazy, but they're all things I've sort of been working on for years and years. And the reason that memoir is still on hold is that the memoir was how I originally got my agent and it didn't sell. And I was absolutely devastated. I quit my job as a teacher to go full time into writing, joined the Writer's Grotto, wrote every day to finish this book that I thought would be published because it had been, excerpts of it had been published in very good outlets like Narrative Magazine. One of the pieces was chosen for Best American Sports Writing. And I had really good response. I got a great agent. And it went out and just crickets. And I was devastated. I mean, I was probably 46, I think, 45 or 46. And I would like walk the dogs at night and cry. So my family didn't know how wrecked I was. And my agent said to me, the thing is, no one knows who you are. And so you have to sell another book first. And I was like, are you crazy? I have no other book. There's no other book. And I had a contract for Broad Strokes within 6 weeks of having that conversation with my agent, because it's a book I'd been thinking about for 30 years.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I think this is also, you know, as much as we're sort of circling around this idea of procrastination, it's also a theme of having many irons in the fire and the almost paradox of them all coming to fruition within a pretty short period of time. And so it's that in and of itself is super inspiring. Well, as we mentioned in your bio, you're also a podcaster, or you were a podcaster on the Grotto's Grotto Pod. And I know that that's where you and Grant originally met. And, you know, we both have learned so much from the amazing writers that we've been lucky to interview on Right Minded. And so if you, in closing, we're wondering if you could tell us if you have a tip or a bit of wisdom that really stuck with you over the years of doing that podcasting that you might leave our listeners with.
The first thing that comes to mind is And I don't know if I can do justice to what she said or if I can even remember exactly what it was, but Julie Lithcott Hames, the writer, memoirist, and nonfiction writer, talked about exposing your heart and writing from your heart. I mean, she wrote a book called Real American that is really, really a tough book about growing up biracial in America. And it just made me feel so inspired, but also like almost like a sword of bravery. Like, I am willing, you have to be willing to be brave. And that bravery is like knowing what your heart wants and knowing what your heart needs to say. And it might not be what you think the market wants. It might not be what you even want to do in this moment. And that's how it is for me with my next book about these French portraitists. I'm like, who is ever going to buy a book about 18th century French portraitists? But someone did. so it's a miracle. So, I mean, I don't know. Listen to your heart sounds so vacuous on one level, and it is so deep and so terrifying and so badass if you can do it.
Those are great words to end on. Thank you so much, Bridget.
Yeah, we're super grateful to have you. Thanks, Bridget, and good luck with all of these projects.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, everybody. We'll be right back with Grant's Takeaway.
Welcome back, everybody, for this week's takeaway. And, you know, talking about procrastination makes me think that it's time to do some introspection about our own procrastination. I didn't think of myself as a procrastinator, but I realize that I am within the kind of productive procrastination definition that Bridget provided. And in fact, I think we're all procrastinators in some way. I don't think there's a way not to be one. There are always tasks we don't want to do in life. So I'd like listeners to think about how you procrastinate. What are the emotions that cause you to procrastinate? Is your procrastination something that hinders you from accomplishing your goals? Or how can you come up with a strategy or a mindset to deal with it once you recognize it? I think recognizing it is so important, and then figuring out how to deal with it. So as part of that, I think we also need to forgive ourselves for procrastinating from time to time, because there are just some unpleasant things to do in our busy lives. And sometimes we need a break, or to just do the productive things we want to do, those things, those other things that are competing for our affections. So I'll leave you with that.
Exactly. It's a both and moment. And remember, everybody, Right Minded is a weekly podcast. You can listen to this podcast while you do other things. So you can multitask, which is like the favorite activity of procrastinators. Remember that you can download Right Minded on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we are in your feed every week with a new feed from another inspiring guest. We'll see you next week.